the last word
with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.
You're very welcome back to The Last Word. Daniel McConnell of the Business Post sitting in for Matt. Now, without question, my next guest has published one of, if not the most explosive books of 2025 so far. The book is called Entitled, and it's a rollicking account of the rise and fall of the House of York, or the Prince Andrew and his ex-wife Sarah Ferguson. The page-turner has revelation after revelation and has caused a firestorm of controversy, especially about claims of physical fighting amongst members of the royal family and, of course, those links with Jeffrey Epstein. It certainly isn't boring. And with me now on the line is the book's author, historian Andrew Lowney. You're very welcome to the programme.
Very nice to talk to you.
What, I suppose, led you in the first instance to write about the House of York and Prince Andrew and Sarah Ferguson in the first instance?
Well, there hadn't been a book on them, really, a proper book. There'd been books sort of 40 years ago, or an authorised book that someone had helped that Sarah had contributed to. But it was actually the third of a trilogy of books on royal marriages. The first on the open marriage of Lord and Lady Mountbatten, the second on the great love story, supposedly, of the Duke and Duchess of Windsor. And this looked at the question of the happiest divorced couple ever, considering whether that was the truth. But clearly, Andrew being in the news recently because of his time as a special envoy and also because of his links with Epstein. And one of the things that struck me was, just in reading the papers over the years, was the way that the two of them had leveraged their royal position for their own personal financial gain. And that was something I wanted to look at in a bit more detail. How did they make their money, and was it done in, shall we say, an above-the-board way? And I was also interested in the relationship between the monarchy and the press, and the rather cosy relationship, which I think had protected them from proper scrutiny.
And in terms of, I suppose, the genesis of this, was it that now infamous interview with Emily Maitlis on the BBC in Newsnight, or, you know, what was the, I suppose, the spark that started you to put pen to paper?
Well, I started researching this in 2021, so after the Newsnight interview, but I had been thinking about it before. I spent a lot of time just going through the old cuts, making lists of people to contact. Eventually, I had 3,000 people that I contacted, of whom 300 talked to me, many of them on the record, many of them very senior figures in diplomats and naval officers. And I think they spoke because they were shocked by the sort of behavior that was going on, and felt that the story should come out, and perhaps it was best coming from a serious historian rather than from a journalist.
And Andrew's position within the royal family, and we will get to the relationship with Sarah Ferguson in a minute, but his relationship within the royal family, I mean, he was exceptionally close to the late Majesty Queen Elizabeth II, and is it your sense through the book that he had been somewhat protected, insulated because of that close relationship?
Yes, I mean, I think that was one of the most shocking disclosures, that the Queen not only turned a blind eye, but actually colluded with him. Indeed, every time he did something wrong, or was caught doing something wrong, she seemed to give him a new honour. I had plenty of accounts of people reporting concerns about his activities to Buckingham Palace, to Number 10, and them just being ignored, and indeed being told that the Queen didn't really want to know about this.
The figure of Sarah Ferguson is a fascinating one because obviously she has seen her fair share of ups and downs, their divorce. I mean, she's been exposed by the tabloids time and time again for rather dubious behaviour, you know, trying to sell access to the royal family, etc. like that. What is your assessment, having done this book, of her as an individual and then in terms of her connection with Prince Andrew and then the wider royal family?
Well, I think she claims, going backwards, she claims a very close link with the royal family, particularly with the Queen. I'm not convinced that's entirely true. We only ever hear Sarah Ferguson's version. I think the royal family feel they need to hold her close. Hold your friends close and your enemies closer, because the danger is that she would spill the beans. And there are constant references throughout the book of her threatening to do so. So I think they just feel they need to keep her on side. But she's very engaging, energetic, in many ways, lots of things to admire. She has this great empathy with the disadvantaged and children, and, you know, does a lot of very useful work for charity. And she's a sort of life enhancer. But at the same time, you know, there are very confused lines between her business activities, her charitable work, and her social life. She is pretty brazen, like her ex-husband, in using her position to make money. So I felt that this was something that, you know, really undermined the institution of the monarchy And they really need to address this, that you can't have even non-working royals behaving in this way. We need, for example, I think a royal register that makes clear how people are spending or earning their money. You don't have other royals, for example, Lord Lindley, ever going into the tabloids because of his work. So there were real concerns about how they were, I would say, exploiting their position.
Mm. And in terms of their as you said in our introduction, I mean they're the ex couple that get on the best of any, it is purported. I mean, is that actually true? You know, notwithstanding that they've each had several ex lovers, they've had partnerships, etc., like that outside of their own relationship, but yet they've continued to live in the same house, and at times they've cohabitated. I mean, talk to me about the dynamic between those two post their divorce.
Well, it is an interesting question. I mean, they separated after 6 years, and here they are living together after 30 after that. I mean, she hangs limpet-like to the royal family because she's nothing without those associations. And certainly the Queen and Prince Philip were very keen to sort of cut her adrift, and she kind of manipulated Andrew and stayed in there. I mean, they have 30 rooms. She has a four-roomed apartment. So she's not really, they're not on top of each other, but they do meet. They're friendly. They co-parent, co-grandparent. And in some ways, they both looked out for each other over the years. When she was, as you say, having all those scandals about sending access to Andrew, he stood by her. But they do work together very closely as business associates, as much as ex-husband and wife. But I mean, they had, I think, pretty much from the beginning, an open relationship. There were plenty of lovers on both sides. And it was only the Queen who was insisting that they divorce in 1996 that actually happened. I think they would have been quite happy ticking over as they were and trying to keep everything under the radar. But it is an intriguing relationship. I mean, they do pretend every so often that they're going to get back together because that's very good for their poll ratings. But I don't think there's any chance of that ever happening.
Obviously, the Prince Andrew story is now inextricably linked with the now convicted paedophile and the late Jeffrey Epstein. Where do they first meet, and where is Sarah Ferguson in the middle of that relationship?
Well, it's a good question. The suggestion is that Andrew met Epstein through Ghislaine Maxwell, who he'd known since the 1980s. And that's what one of her friends has told me. But my own feeling is it makes more sense for Sarah Ferguson and Ghislaine to have met on the social circuit in New York, and the link to have been made that way, probably in the early 2000s, sort of in the 1990s. Andrew claims that he only met Epstein in the late 90s. In fact, his own private secretary has written to the Times saying it was in the early 1990s. Steve Hoffenberg, an associate of Epstein, puts it at 1991.
Mm. So they knew almost a decade almost a decade before.
Exactly. And they also say that they didn't have any contact with Epstein after 2010, the famous trip across to say goodbye. But in fact, from legal depositions, from eyewitness statements I've had, they were seeing him as late as 2015.
Mm.
And they were seeing him more than one imagines. I mean, Andrew had a suite at the house,
yes,
called the Britannia Suite.
And you say in the book that Andrew was essentially easy prey for the rattlesnake, Epstein, and he was played by him, and he was almost the court jester, the fool. Why did you come to that conclusion?
Well, I mean, he was a useful idiot. I mean, Epstein was a very sophisticated operator, as was Ghislaine, and they played and used Andrew. So he was someone who gave them status, gave them useful contacts, particularly contacts he's built up as a special trade representative. And in turn, Epstein gave Andrew useful business contacts. He gave him a ready supply of women. He settled many of Sarah Ferguson's debts. So it was a win-win situation for both of them.
Mm. And obviously, all of the movements between Epstein and Andrew came out at the time around the Newsnight interview, etc. like that. There was a huge amount of press attention. In terms of fresh revelations, I mean, have you been able to uncover other than, I suppose, confirming the longer standing relationships they have? I mean, are there more damaging revelations contained in the book as to their relationship?
Oh, yes, there's a lot of stuff on Epstein. I mean, a lot of testimony from, for example, Epstein's driver, the managers of his island, Deborah Gale, who's the housekeeper in Palm Beach, former girls who were trafficked there and saw Andrew, a woman who Andrew was involved with. So, yes, there's a lot more about Epstein and Andrew's relationship with him. More testimony of people seeing him with Epstein, or rather with Virginia Giuffre, both in Trump and on the island.
And do you get any, and because I want to move on to about the money shortly, but like, is there any, do you come to a conclusion about his decision to go to Epstein to say that farewell in New York, even when those allegations of the trafficking had come out? I mean, are we any clear as to why the prince made such an ill-judged decision?
Yes, I mean, I've heard different versions. One girlfriend said that he'd gone to get a reassurance from Epstein that Epstein wasn't going to blackmail him from the compromat he had from sort of, in effect, honey traps. We know that Epstein filmed all the men that came to his properties. I mean, the woman called Juliet Bryant has actually went into the control room to see the cameras. And these things were, the cameras and the films were picked up by the FBI in 2006. I think the main reason is he went there to catch some more money for his ex-wife. But there are also stories that he came to do some business arrangements with the, involving Casanova's, a stockbroking firm. So I think there were lots of reasons why he went, but saying goodbye was not really one of them.
And in terms of the money, as we said, I mean, he went looking for someone, or it's purported that he went looking for money for Sarah Ferguson. But I'm interested to find out how Andrew and Sarah Ferguson lived on, how did they made money. And but it's clear from your book that he received a series of handouts and bailouts from the royal family, from the late Queen and now the current King Charles.
Yes, I mean, I think he inherited money under with trust funds from probably his grandmother. The Queen supported him. She's paid off, as you say, debts for Sarah Ferguson. I think Charles supported him. He was paying, for example, for a yogi who used to come in and administer to Andrew at Royal Lodge. So, and they had money. They'd sold this Swiss chalet for, I think, 14 million. So, I mean, they'd never really been short of money. I've never really understood it. I mean, the book delineates just how much money Sarah was making. I mean, she was spending it pretty quickly too, but making huge sums of money from, you know, endorsing Weight Watchers and Wedgwood China and being a brand endorsement, doing brand endorsements for all sorts of, you know, cooking projects, you know, way before Meghan Markle was doing this. But, you know, they also, Andrew had money that he made from Pitch at the Palace, which was meant to be a charity, but in which he took a 10% slice of any investor income that went in. We've had several court cases where unexplained sums were paid to him, which were clearly payments for some sort of service he provided. There have been stories about him taking commission, for example, from a Greek water firm trying to develop a business in Kazakhstan. So, I mean, there were lots and lots of different sources. I mean, we've had Teng Bo, the alleged Chinese spy, and his activities in China on behalf of the Duke, and the fact the Duke actually had a bank account in China. So his finances are very opaque, and we only occasionally get glimpses of things. But he has an accountant who has already been reprimanded several times for the way he conducts his accounting. There have been criticisms of the fact Andrew uses nominee names in accounts, nominee accounts, gives a false name in some of the accounts. And both he and Sarah Ferguson have accounts which are not properly audited because they argue that there isn't sufficient number of transactions going through them. But they have numerous of these accounts, which doesn't make sense if they aren't doing any business.
And it's a fascinating, so it's a fascinating web of financial sort of intrigue. One of the, I'm just conscious of our time. One of the most fascinating claims in the book, Andrew, is this notion that Prince Harry gave Andrew a bloody nose during a heated argument at a 2013 family gathering. Now, that's been denied by the Sussexes. But you're standing by, essentially, by your story and standing by your source in relation to that. Just walk us through very briefly as to the circumstances of that altercation.
Well, I mean, there were two altercations, one in 2013 and one in 2017. In fact, this was literally a paragraph in the book. It was put in at the behest of the publisher, who just casually asked what the relations were with Harry. The first was when Andrew, who's the godfather, was telling Harry that he felt he, you know, he needed to get his life in order. Harry reacted rather, was very angry about that. And that's when there was the bloody nose. Then the second occasion was in 2017 where Andrew said that Harry was making a mistake with Meghan Markle, there hadn't been due diligence, she wasn't a suitable bride. It's the sort of thing that William, we know, was saying, and certainly when I was researching my book on Mountbatten, it was the sort of thing I was being told by members of the royal household. So I don't think there are any surprises there. I mean, he's clearly supporting the honour of his wife, but there's nothing defamatory there. Mm-hmm. I noticed his popularity ratings went up when people said he'd given Andrew a bloody nose. But I'm standing by my sources. We just have to agree to differ. We have put a denial in the book. So I hope Honor is satisfied.
Well, it is a fascinating account, and I could honestly talk about this story for another half an hour. But for the moment, Andrew Lowney, I wish you the rest with the book. The book is called entitled The Rise and Fall of the House of York, and it is published by William Collins, and it's in all good bookstores now.
The Last Word with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.